Welcome to the Fund the People podcast. I'm your host, Rusty Stahl. I'm president and CEO of Fund the People, where our mission is to maximize investment in America's nonprofit workforce. We give funders and nonprofits cutting-edge ideas, research, and tools to help drive equity, effectiveness, and endurance in the social sector. So let's start the show. Welcome to the show, everyone. In this episode, you'll hear how one human services nonprofit CEO has built up an HR department from scratch and how he helped staff navigate the pandemic. We discuss his experience working inside state government, where he was in charge of contracting with nonprofits, and how he is now leveraging government and philanthropic funding in his current role. I first heard our guest, Shahir Mustafa, speak on a Center for Effective Philanthropy webinar in the summer of 2023. This is when they had just released their Nonprofit Voice report, which documents how staffing issues are the number one issue facing the sector. I was so impressed by his experience and his perspective that I really wanted to have him come on to the podcast. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest before I bring him on. Shahir Mustafa became president and CEO of Hopewell in 2016. Prior to joining Hopewell, Shahir served at the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families, managing child protective services across 31 cities and towns. He has supported children, families, and teams of staff throughout his career. Shahir holds a master's in clinical social work from Boston College. He's a board member for the Children's League of Massachusetts. And he recently completed the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Children and Family Fellowship. I'm pleased to bring you my conversation with Shahir Mustafa. Thanks again for your service, your work, and thanks for coming on to the Fund the People podcast. And I was excited to hear from you on that webinar that the Center for Effective Philanthropy did in August, I think, or July, somewhere back there.
Yeah, summertime.
Summertime.
Feels like forever ago.
Yeah, about that research they did on the state of the nonprofit sector and what funders need to know. I've been attending the Center for Effective Philanthropy conference this week, and so wanted to capture some of your perspective and thoughts. You know, I'm interviewing some funders at the conference, but I'm constantly trying to make sure we have nonprofit voices on as well. So kind of before we dive into your work here and your take on what's happening, I always ask folks to give me a little bit of what motivated you or motivates you to do, you know, social work, social change work, in your case, you know, with children and families.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I would say, first of all, thank you for the opportunity and just for elevating this conversation. Appreciate it. So, it starts with my mom. I was raised by my mom. She raised my brother and I as a single parent, working a couple different jobs to make sure we had everything that we needed. But she was a special educator. And so, from a very early age, she was my model in terms of service, and always practice generosity and kindness in the community and with everybody she came in contact with. So that was, I internalized that, I believe. But it was not always easy. I got into a lot of trouble as a kid, and I actually ended up in detox twice. And it was through that process of getting clean that I basically did a lot of internal work. And while that was painful, I had to kind of process my trauma and my challenges in ways that, to me, I wanted to leverage that lived experience to help with the healing of others. And so committed my life to service in my late teens, early 20s. And that's really what led me to this work.
Thanks for sharing. That's a deeply personal story. Can you then tell us what happened from there? An introduction to your career journey coming out of that commitment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it was as I mentioned, it was a rough time. I actually dropped out of college to get my life in order. And that was a critical time. I just worked. I painted houses. I did construction. I worked in retail. I did all sorts of things. I knew I needed to be working and get focused on myself. And once I started to build up some sobriety behind me, re-enrolled in college, and I was able to get into a program that combined a bachelor's with a master's at Boston College. So I was able to pursue my graduate degree while I was earning undergraduate credits. And, you know, growing up, my father was not around as much as I would have liked, I think, but he was a doctor. He was a physician. And so from a very early age, it was programmed into me that I was going to be a doctor. And so when I decided to pursue a degree in social work, that was a pivot, we'll just say. And again, even my mom, who was, I mentioned her generosity and kindness, I think even she was worried about my future in terms of being able to put food on the table and what that would mean for me. But I just knew it spoke to me. It was my calling, and pursued that rigorously. And yeah, so that was, I became a therapist. I worked with kids and families involved in the child welfare system. And so my entire career from the time I was 22 until now, I'm 45, has been working with kids and families involved in child welfare. And I was a therapist for almost 15 years and started to step into roles of leadership, running programs. I ran a residential school, worked in a therapeutic after school program. And then I got recruited to work for the Department of Children and Families. So I did child protection work across 31 cities and towns in the metro Boston area here in Massachusetts. And I did that for about 6 years. It was a appointed position through the governor's office, and got to work, see the work firsthand inside the department. And did that, as I said, for about 6 years until I had the opportunity to lead Hopewell, a nonprofit organization. So that's my first role as a CEO, and I started there in 2016.
Great. Well, thank you for bringing us up to speed. So now let's talk about Hopewell. What's the mission and what does it do?
The formal mission is to enrich the lives and expand the opportunities of kids and families in need of love, support, and safe places to grow and thrive. So that's our formal mission statement. And I can talk about what we do. I'll get to that in a moment. But I think it's important to start with why we do it. And I think that's a key distinction, because our why is really what drives every decision that we make, from our strategy to our programs to our approach. It's our ethos. And perhaps we'll get into this, but kids experiencing foster care are our nation's most marginalized group of young people, and the data bears this out. And kids experiencing foster care come into the system through no fault of their own, and that is fundamentally unjust, in my opinion, that our system, which is designed to protect them, sets them up for a lifetime of poverty and, for males, incarceration. So we believe that's fundamentally unjust. So our why is really driven towards righting that wrong, disrupting those systems, and ensuring equitable outcomes for kids. How we do that and what we do is, we talk about keeping our head in the clouds and our feet on the ground. So we do programmatic work that's very proximate. So we recruit, license, train foster parents. We're the largest nonprofit provider of foster care in Massachusetts. We have a host of other programs to support kids and families involved in child welfare. So that's the kind of tactical on the ground work. But simultaneous to that, we are engaged in systems healing, systems reform, systems change work. So we are trying to effectuate public policy and to change the narrative around what we accept as the standard of care for kids in foster care. Instead of a system that really just makes sure that they're safe, we want to ensure that children are thriving. So when I say we have our head in the clouds and feet on the ground, the feet on the ground is that programmatic work. The head in the clouds is that system change work.
Wow. And has Hopewell always done the head in the clouds and the feet on the ground, or is that something more recent under your tenure in terms of the policy and systems work?
I would say that's a newer strategic directive since I came into this role.
Great. I thought that was the case, but I wasn't sure.
I'm pleased to introduce our season 6 sponsor, Loftus Partners. Are you frustrated with a lack of progress on equitable pay in your organization? Look no further than Loftus Partners, your go-to source for human resources consulting with a unique twist. Loftus Partners is not just a consulting firm. They are a 100% woman-owned powerhouse at the intersection of HR, organizational development, and social justice, with a focus on nonprofits. They've launched
the Pay Equity Collective, a peer learning experience that provides capacity building, strategic resources, and a supportive community for nonprofits seeking pathways to pay equity. Visit payequitycollective.com to learn more. Loftus Partners, empowering organizations and advancing equity one collective step at a time. Before we go further talking about Hopewell, I think the audience would like to hear about your view as a gubernatorial appointee in government in an agency that has such a connection to nonprofits and the people who do the work in them. Because one thing at Fund the People we've been talking about on this podcast and thinking about is what is the right relationship between government and nonprofits, whether it's funding or otherwise. So just curious for you to talk for a minute about what that was like as a government funder. Did you think about investing in the nonprofit workforce as part of the funding that the agency provided? And how did others around you in the government view the role of the nonprofit sector and of nonprofit professionals? Did they see it or talk about it at all?
So I think the simple answer is not really. And I think I just have to set the context. So when I was at DCF, it was, 2010 to 2016, roughly. So you have to put yourself back in that time, pre-pandemic, Baker administration. Baker came in and launched a bunch of different reform efforts, which were really internally pointed. So the department was looking at its own policies on keeping kids safe, on family engagement, et cetera. So I would say that the primary emphasis was more internal at that time to kind of ensure that the department was operating in ways that were aligned with its own mission and effectuating effective policy in that regard. There was not a ton of external focus, at least from where I was seated. That doesn't mean that wasn't happening, but it wasn't necessarily something that I was exposed to. Since the pandemic, I can say that, we may get into this a little bit later, but some of the other roles that I play at the Providers Council and board chair for the Children's League of Massachusetts, I absolutely see a lot of engagement with the nonprofit sector in partnering with the state to create an ecosystem of support for kids and families.
Yeah, well, that's an important distinction. It's just so interesting that with a reform-focused leadership, it's about the internal reform, which is so important, but that it's sort of disconnected maybe from some of the partners.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it sequentially. So it's almost a similar experience I had when I came here to this organization in 2016. It was almost like we needed to get our own house in order. And I'll talk about that when we talk about kind of human resources and workforce development. So we had to get our own house in order before we could even think about the engagement piece. And so that's not to say, as I mentioned, that didn't happen. I think it was a timing issue of when I was there and the role I was in and when I left. Right. That's not to say that those conversations weren't happening or didn't happen, but it's not a part of what I was exposed to as much.
So let's turn to Hopewell then. You started in 2016 as president and CEO. What did you sort of inherit and when you got here in terms of workforce and support systems for the people here? And how many people were working here? Give us a little bit of a lay of the land.
Yeah, so about a $25 million budget, roughly 200 staff. Essentially what I inherited was, I would say, is not uncommon for a lot of human service organizations. So for example, we did not have an HR department. We had a part-time person whose responsibility was essentially renewing benefits. We were outsourcing any sort of employee relations work to attorneys, which was incredibly expensive. There was no internal capacity that you would expect from an HR team. One of the very first things that I did was hire a chief human resource officer who has since built out our entire workforce engagement strategy. So it started, again, internally focused, getting our house in order. So things like performance reviews, those were not happening prior to 2016, at least not consistently and at all levels of the organization. So implementing a performance management process, training supervisors and leaders in the organization on how to conduct those benefits renewals, more comprehensive benefit offerings, a compensation strategy, salary grades. These were all things that were built since 2016 because they just did not exist. And as I mentioned, you know, there are certainly exceptions, but a lot of human service organizations, because of the funding mechanism, that is seen as almost like a luxury because it's not directly related to programs and the contracts are so lean. There's not extra resources or what would be considered extra resources. I'm using air quotes to fund that type of work. But we believe that it's critically important because at the end of the day, it's people that are doing this work. So if we don't invest in them, then that has a direct connection to the communities that we're serving and supporting. And we're actually pulling away from the impact we can have on them. So,
well, let's give a shout out to that hire, that HR person. Tell us her name. And
Leah Janey. And nobody try to poach her is all I can say. So Leah is a beast. She's the best human resource professional I've ever worked with, hands down.
Well, I'd love to get her on the show sometime.
Absolutely.
You told
me
she came from Youth Build, right?
She did. Yeah. She came from Youth Build USA. So she has a lot of experience building these teams and building infrastructure. And it's something that she carries a lot of passion about. We're very, very fortunate to have her.
Great. So you've sort of started talking about how you began making these shifts. I'm interested in hearing what systems you've built in addition to creating or as an extension of creating that HR team. And how did you pay for it? Given the lean contracts, and was the budget primarily government contracts? And how have you integrated philanthropic fundraising in and sort of built out these systems?
Essentially, the funding, when I came on board, 99.9% government contracts, state contracts. We did have about $6 million that was sitting in CDs at the time. And there was a bit of a reluctance to invest that money in the market. So that was something that I discussed with the board, with the finance team, and we ultimately made that decision. We timed the market really well. That has now grown significantly. And we do have an investment policy which allows us to make a draw on that. We have yet not really even had to do that though. So we've also incorporated philanthropy. So as I mentioned, it was 99.9% state funding. As of this past year, the revenue breakdown is more like 82%, 18%. So we've increased our philanthropic contributions, which has allowed us to do so many things, which is really, you know, the crux of what I hope we get to talk about today is what that has allowed in terms of innovation, investment, impact. All of these things have allowed us to take the organization to another level, where if we had just stayed solely funded by state contracts, we would just stay at a steady pace that provides the bare minimum for kids and families. And we just fundamentally believe, as I mentioned, that they deserve more than that. Essentially, what we have done is, you know, as I mentioned, it was just putting the basic infrastructure in the first few years. But at this point now, if we were using like a house analogy, we're putting in natural stone countertops, nice tile backsplashes, you know, radiant heating in the floors, you name it. We're working on it because our people deserve that. And the kids and families we support deserve that. So we have things like conditionless student loan pay down, where we provide $3,000 a year to pay towards someone's principal student loans. We have all sorts of wellness initiatives and wellness programs that we run through our HR team. We have a compensation strategy where our goal is to pay at the 75th percentile across all positions, because we just fundamentally believe the people doing this work deserve to be compensated for the quality of work that they're providing. And they are essential workers. They're providing an essential service to our community. And it's not volunteer work. They should be compensated fairly. They shouldn't be living in poverty or receiving supports in the same way that we're trying to offer to others, which is sadly often the case for a lot of people that choose to do this work. So we want to compensate people fairly and create a lot of learning and growth opportunities. So we have all sorts of internal and external training opportunities, learning and growth opportunities that we fund and support and encourage our teams to participate in, because it makes them better leaders, it makes them better practitioners, better professionals in this work, which again has a direct impact on the kids and families that we're supporting. And ultimately, we're really building a culture of belonging, which I'll get to as well when we think about incorporating people with lived experience in foster care and BIPOC people into our organization.
That's incredible. In a fairly short amount of time, it's not even 10 years since you've been building this out. And it One of the things I didn't put in, I think, the questions I prepared, but it's something we talked about in our prep call, was some of the innovation programmatic that you've been able to do. And I think it's connected. It seems like it's connected to what you've done with that internal getting your house in order. I'm able to not just build out the heated floors, but, you know, a new garden that's like growing externally. So talk about how supporting people and building these support systems internally has enabled you to launch new initiatives externally.
Yeah, 100%. So again, all of this is pointed towards that why, right? This fundamentally unjust system that creates these inequitable outcomes. So everything that we're doing is pointing towards that. So we're investing in our workforce, it's to disrupt those outcomes. When we're getting our house in order, it's to disrupt those outcomes. And so one of the things that our sector has lacked in historically, and again, this is connected to the funding mechanism, is innovation and creativity. So take, for example, kids exiting foster care. Only 3% will get a post-secondary degree. So we have a program that we brought to scale. We partnered with an organization out in California, First Place for Youth, shout out to them, and brought their model here to Boston. So that was seeded by philanthropy and now is, you know, has a strong foothold here in the community. And we've served over 100 kids in that program since it launched, who otherwise would have been homeless. But upstream, we know that, for example, third grade reading proficiency is a huge driver of future academic attainment, as well as just life outcomes, right? Like they actually determine how many prisons to build based off third grade reading proficiency levels, which is a scary, scary metric if you think of it in that way. And kids experiencing foster care read way, way, way below their non-foster peers at a third grade level. So we partnered with Liberty Mutual. They did helped us do a research and discovery around models out there nationally, how we could build something here in Massachusetts to address this academic opportunity gap. And through their corporate strategy and research team, we did about a 3-month engagement with them, got a ton of research, and effectively learned that there really is nothing like this that exists in the country, which is also sad. So we built it. And they helped us with the business model, the infrastructure, all the things that we needed to do to execute on this. And then we raised money and used our own strategic cash reserves to launch it. And so at this point now, we have this bespoke, first of its kind, third grade reading proficiency model that leverages high impact tutoring and educational support specifically designed for kids experiencing foster care that just would not have been possible without philanthropy. Full stop. And so we are learning and we're refining the model. And our goal ultimately is to scale this so that it becomes an entitlement support for any kid experiencing foster care so that they don't end up incarcerated ultimately, and so that we can disrupt those academic and life outcomes.
Shout out also to Ralph Smith for the third grade reading level initiative.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who has put that kind of on the map for the funders mm-hmm. and others. So those are two initiatives. They have names, right? And people can find them on your
website. Yes. The literacy program is called RISE. And the support for the housing first approach for youth aging out of foster care is called My First Place.
Great.
Yeah.
Let's give people the website now.
Sure.
We'll do it again at the end.
Yeah. So it's www.hopewellinc.org.
All right. You've talked to me a little bit about, in our prep call, about moving toward increased representation and leadership from people with lived experience of foster care within the organization. Can you tell us about that journey? You know, it's an equity initiative or effort within your overall investments in your team.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, quite honestly, it starts with my own experience in leadership. So as a man of color coming up in this work, I was often the only person of color in leadership circles myself. And when I became the CEO here, at the time, I was one of only 6 CEOs in human services that were people of color. That number's grown a little bit, but it's still got to be under like 20 statewide. And you think about the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Massachusetts residents supported by these types of organizations, that underrepresentation is stark. So I just have a personal connection to this. And so we invested in recruiting and retaining BIPOC talent at every level of the organization. So what you see a lot of times is direct service might have a higher ratio of people of color. And then as you get up into higher levels of the organization and boards, the whiter it tends to be. So we have about 60% of our staff are BIPOC. Right now, our executive leadership team of seven, four out of seven are people of color. Our board, at the time when I got here, we had one board member who was of color. Now we are 5 out of 15. And then on top of that, we have made a very intentional effort to bring people with lived experience in foster care into the organization, and again, at every level of the organization. So a third of our board have lived experience in foster care. Member of our executive leadership team, and at every level of the organization, we have people with lived experience in foster care. And to me, that is just so critical. This is a population that has been really disempowered and silenced in decision-making around their whole lives because they come into the system as kids. Kids are generally disempowered, let alone kids experiencing foster care. So you have these systems and these strangers effectively making decisions on their behalf. And we just believe that that's not just. And so we want to center them, share power with them, and create opportunities for people with lived experience to shape our systems and make them more equitable.
So you went from one person on a board of 15 who was a person of color to five. How long did that take, and what sort of process had to happen to make that shift?
Yeah, so that was 2016. There was one, and I think we got to five. It might even be more than five now. It might be six, actually. Within the past year, I would say, we got to that number. But it started with just transparent conversations with the board. And to their credit, this is something that they acknowledged and they recognized that they believe needed to shift and change. And they were on board with the idea. And so as certain board members sunsetted or stepped down off the board, we prioritized. And again, not in a way that's tokenizing, right? So we're not going to bring somebody onto our board just because they're a person of color. But, you know, we did a gap analysis around certain, you know, areas that we wanted to have, areas of expertise on our board. So if we could prioritize somebody with a legal background who was also a person of color, then we're going to do that. And we weren't just going to settle for, well, I know this person, let me bring them on. We waited, we did outreach, we leveraged our networks. And we also brought people on in cohorts so that we didn't create this tokenization experience.
Terrific. Thank you. I think that'll be really helpful to people listening. In a cohort, is it two, three? It doesn't matter, as long as it's not.
More than one, we'll say.
More than one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. We also wanted to be careful too, because we have a culture on our board. And I think, quite honestly, the board has an appreciation for the expertise of this executive team and acknowledges that they have, you know, oversight responsibilities, of course, but the management and leadership of the organization needs to be left to the executive leadership team. And so they really respect that. And so they wanted to maintain that type of culture. And so we didn't want to bring on, you know, six, seven, eight new board members that could really throw the balance of the culture off. So we tried to do it in two, three at a time so that people could be integrated into the existing culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as you referenced earlier, looking externally, you've taken on some leadership roles, big leadership roles. I don't know how you're doing it all, but that's a different question. Sort of advocating on children and family issues, but also on some of these workforce issues related to the sector. So can you talk a little bit about what you've been doing and how it's going?
Yeah. So here in Massachusetts, we have, like all states, I would imagine, there are trade associations that represent human services. And then there's children's advocacy organizations as well. So I'm the board chair of the Children's League of Massachusetts. So that's a children advocacy organization. Sometimes trade issues get mixed in there because, you know, for example, the workforce crisis that we're facing has a direct impact on services that are rendered for on behalf of kids and families. But typically CLM doesn't wade into trade issues as much. But I'm also the vice chair of the Massachusetts Council of Human Service Providers. So they are very clearly a trade association. And, you know, this is their work, is to ensure that contracts are funding, you know, the actual cost to render services, to render high quality services. And so what ended up happening was we're realizing that they were all advocating for things independent, and that if they were to combine their advocacy efforts, they could be much more powerful and effective in providing a unified perspective. And so that's exactly what they did. So the board chairs and executive directors of each of the four trades came together and created what is called the collaborative. And the collaborative is that group of people So of course, there are times where maybe Providers Council is doing its own thing or Children's League is doing its own thing. But as it relates to this workforce challenge, they have really kind of aligned their efforts. And, you know, because we're seeing the challenges across the board. And so one area that we have looked at is the way that they set rates here in Massachusetts. So they use the Bureau of Labor Statistics benchmark. And in Massachusetts, historically, they've been using the 50th percentile. And if you look at the cost of living, for example, here in Massachusetts, it far exceeds the 50th percentile. So if they're using a metric that falls below what is, you know, kind of relative here in Massachusetts, that's a problem. And so we have been advocating for the rate setting process to increase to at least the 75th percentile. If we're going to go based off of cost of living, it should probably be more like the 90th percentile. So we have seen some movement there and some commitment from the administration that they acknowledge that this is a challenge and that they need to increase funding. But that's one way that we have combined our efforts, pointed towards something directly related to rates and compensation.
What does that look like for somebody who's not a statistician on the percentiles? Like, can you give me a sense of?
Yeah. So let's just to use round numbers. Let's say you're rendering a service and the state reimburses you $100 a day. They come up with that $100 a day by using a formula. And part of that formula is how much it costs to pay your workforce. And they use this Bureau of Labor Statistics benchmark as how they're arriving at that cost. But that cost is not the actual cost because you're hiring people here in Massachusetts. So if they're saying, all right, $50 out of that 100 is to pay for your workforce, but it's actually costing you 75, you're already losing $25 just by providing this service. So that's kind of how it works. So we're saying, no, you need to pay us $75 because that's how much it actually costs. But the state has historically been kind of behind in terms of what today's market. And then when we see with inflation, the impact of the pandemic, the increases for compensation and what the state needs to do to keep up has just only accelerated. So it's something that we really need to get ahead of.
Yeah. It's great to hear that the groups have come together on it in a unified front, if you will. What is the response from the government like?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say they understand the challenge and they are willing partners. At the end of the day, it just boils down to, you know, I mean, this is expensive. It's going to require a big injection of capital into the human services sector in order to address this issue. It's a political environment. They have to, you know, they have a lot of other stakeholders they have to consider, but they're committed. They're working with us. I would say it's incremental. They're hearing us and they have shown some signs that they are going to be making these changes, but it's incremental. Yeah.
I think this issue is bubbling up all over the country in terms of, it seems like there's multiple contracting issues between governments, whether it's a metropolitan, state, or federal, in terms of like the practice of reimbursing versus paying upfront, timing of contracting and payment and rates and cost of living adjustments as well. And all of these things, I think people across the country are speaking out on these issues, and we'll see how responsive the various governments can be and will be.
And I don't envy the position that they're in. I mean, it's a tough one. If you're working for ANF here in Massachusetts, it's, you know, that's a tough spot to be. Again, they know what it is, but I mean, they have a lot of responsibilities in an entire Commonwealth that they need to ensure that there's a safety net to support. So it's, I get the challenges, but we, you know, we have a responsibility to advocate from our perspective.
Right. So as I said at the beginning, we initially connected after I saw you speak on this webinar with Center for Effective Philanthropy. And they released this research in the summer about what they think funders need to know about the state of the nonprofit sector. It was a survey basically of nonprofit leaders. And one of the major findings was, you know, that addressing staffing issues, and it included staff salaries, burnout, and ability to recruit and retain people, that bundle of staffing issues taken together is the number one issue facing nonprofits right now across the country. That's the number one thing they want funders to know and to understand and to respond to. So curious to hear how your folks here at Hopewell are experiencing and dealing with the sort of all the ramifications we've all been going through, and what you're seeing in the ecosystem around you with other human services providers and nonprofits. And it's a big challenge, obviously, for executive leaders. So curious what your thoughts are for addressing this here at Hopewell and across the field.
Yeah. So again, I think it's important to hold the context. So when I started in 2016, we didn't really raise any private dollars, and we've built infrastructure to support that. And I've built relationships with funders over that time. And if we went back 20 years, I'd probably have a different answer for this. But because of when I started doing this, my experience is that trust-based philanthropy practices were becoming much more of a mainstream ethos in fundraising practices. We still have a long way to go, but I think people understand it differently than, say, 20 years ago. So that has helped, I will say. We still have a lot of restricted gifts that are, you know, driven towards specific programs, but we are seeing an increase in unrestricted dollars. And I just want to name that and acknowledge that that is what I believe is needed so that, you know, we can have the flexibility to allocate those resources as we need to. And again, addressing this stereotype, perception, mental model that we hold around overhead also has shifted somewhat, needs to continue to shift. Because again, at the end of the day, I think we've taken for granted that people will do this work. And what we're seeing now is that they're not. They're not going to do this work. And they're not going to do it if they're not compensated in ways that make sense for them and their family, which I agree with. I understand. So it's going to push us all to shift our mental models around, you know, what does it mean to compensate people fairly? And who deserves to be compensated fairly? And what does that say about the communities that we're supporting, you know, that we'll tolerate low-level care and quality of services? I mean, that I think we all have to reckon with that and look at that internally. So we have the fortunate position, as I mentioned, that we have some strategic cash reserves that, you know, we want to make sure because it gives us a cushion to take some risks. But at the same time, we are making these investments because we know it's what our workforce needs today. So these, we are doing, you know, very competitive bonuses, reviewing our entire compensation philosophy. We've increased our compensation by 20% since the pandemic, and we're going to continue to increase it because that's what the market is demanding. We can't hire social workers. If we can't hire social workers, kids and families are going to enter the foster care system because we can't do the diversionary work. That's the reality. So we need to do it. So we're going to do it. I don't know what the sustainable plan is. I mean, we're reaching out to foundations, individual donors. We're trying to increase that unrestricted funding so that we can make this sustainable. But on some level, like, that's a luxury for me to think about. I can't think about what we're going to do in 3 years or 5 years, because if we don't do what we need to do today, we won't even be around in 3 years or 5 years. That's how I'm looking at it. And so far, the philanthropic sector has understood this, supported it, and kept us going. I believe that's going to continue based off of previous experience.
Well, you're a man of action. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we can't look too far down the road and worry about it. We have to do what needs to be done now.
That's right.
As we wrap up here, any other messages you would want to share, if this were not a podcast, but a plenary keynote address in a room of government and funder foundation leaders?
Yeah, I think it goes to this idea of mental models. And I just think about the history of philanthropy, the history of human services. And it's important that we understand that in the mental models that created these systems. They're rooted in perceptions around poverty, perceptions on charity, and what's good enough for people. And I think we need to examine those mental models. We need to reckon with that and reckon with our own complicitness, hero mentalities that we have in nonprofit spaces. We just purchased a couple properties for our My First Place program, and they're beautiful. And I could imagine somebody might walk in there and be like, wow, this is kind of nice. Does a kid in foster care really need something this nice? Yeah, they do. They do need something that nice. They deserve that. And if we can provide it and we can offer it, we should. So I think there's an examination of our mental models that really needs to happen if we're going to create the healing and the change that our systems really require. Otherwise, we're just going to reimagine and remake the system in the existing mold, and we're just going to dress it up a little differently. So these are equity issues. I'm a hopeful person, so I think we're moving in that direction, but it's not going to happen without work. and committed focus. So I appreciate the trends that we're seeing around trust-based philanthropy. I think we need to see more of that. We need to see partnership with nonprofits. And in the human services space, the last thing that I'll say is historically, it's been like, well, the state handles that. That's not philanthropy's role. But as you can see, the state is not going to drive innovation. The state is going to provide kind of the bare minimum. And quite honestly, like that's fine. I don't expect the state to do more than that. But if philanthropy can augment, that to me is the formula for how we drive innovation and increased outcomes. So philanthropy doesn't have to own it, but they have a role. And I think it's that three-legged stool between the nonprofit sector, philanthropy, and our state partners that will drive the outcomes that our communities deserve.
Terrific. That is a great way to end here. Are there things people need to know, like your web address again, or any other resources or ways to get in touch with you or Hopewell?
Yeah. So our website is www.hopewellinc.org. You can follow us on social media. And if anybody ever wants to reach out to me, please don't be a stranger. I'm on LinkedIn. And through our website, you can reach out to me as well. You know, our goal is to collaborate with people because we can't do this work alone. And so if there's anything that we can do to support kids and families experiencing foster care, to support changes in philanthropy, again, it all comes down to that why and why we're doing this work. So I see all of that as shifting outcomes.
Shahir, thank you so much for your time and for your service and your leadership. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it too, Rusty.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Shahir Mustafa as much as I did. Stay tuned to the Fund the People podcast. Next week, we have returning guest Chitra Iyer from Just Futures. She's going to offer concrete advice about providing good retirement savings benefits in nonprofits. So stay tuned to Fund the People. Thanks for listening to Fund the People podcast. Visit fundthepeople.org and click on podcast to find a transcript for this and other episodes and all the links discussed in the episode. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate a 5-star rating and a quick review if possible on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people to find the show. Thank you for driving change in our communities. Remember to keep your tank full. Take care of yourself and take care of one another.